never leaves her nunnery. Drusilla, daughter of one of the petty kings to the east, snickered. Tell me, if the king's sister and brother marry, how is it other than incest? Half-sister and foster-brother, you goose, said Elaine. But tell me, Lady Morgaine, was it only his scars and lameness that deterred you? Kai is no beauty, certainly, but he would be a good husband. I'm not deceived by you, Morgaine retorted, pretending a good humour she didn't feel. Did these women think of nothing but marriage? You care nothing for my wedded happiness with Kai. You merely wished for a wedding to break the monotony of the summer. But you shouldn't be greedy. Sir Griflet was married to Melias last spring, and that should be weddings enough for now. She glanced at Melias, whose dress had already begun to grow tight over her pregnant body. You will even have a babe to fuss and coo over this time next year. But you are long unmarried, Lady Morgaine, said Eleanor of Garlis, and you could hardly have hoped for a better match than the king's own foster-brother. I am in no great haste to be wed, and Kai had no more mind to me than I to him. Guinevere chuckled. True, he has a tongue near as waspish as your own, and no sweet temper. His wife will need more patience than the saintly Bridget, and you, Morgaine, are ever ready with a sharp answer. And besides, if she should marry, she would have to spin for her household, Milius said. As usual, Morgaine is shirking her share of the spinning. Her own spindle began to twirl again, and the reel sank slowly toward the floor. Morgaine shrugged. It's true. I had rather card wool, but there is no more to card, she said, and reluctantly took up the drop spindle. You are the best spinner among us, though, said Guinevere. Your thread is always even and never breaks. Mine breaks if one looks at it. I have always been neat-handed. Perhaps I am simply tired of spinning since my mother taught me when I was so young, Morgaine conceded, and began, reluctantly, to turn the thread in her fingers. True, she hated spinning, and shirked it when she could. Twisting, turning the thread in her fingers, willing her body to stillness with only her fingers twisting as the reel turned and turned, sinking to the floor, down and then up, twist and twist between her hands. All too easy it was to sink into trance. The women were gossiping over the little affairs of the day. Melias and her morning sickness, a woman who had come from Lot's court with scandalous tales of Lot's lechery. I could tell them much if I would. Not even his wife's niece escaped his lecherous hands. It took me all my thought and sharp tongue to keep out of his bed. He cares not, maiden or matron, duchess or dairymaid, so it wears a skirt. Twist the thread, twist again. Watch the spindle turning, turning. Gwydion must be a great boy by now, 3 years old, ready for a toy sword and wooden knights, such as she had made for Gareth, instead of pet kittens and knuckle bones. She remembered Arthur's weight on her lap when she was a little girl here at Caerleon in Uther's court. How fortunate it was that Gwydion didn't resemble his father. A small replica of Arthur at Lot's court would have made tongues wag indeed. Soon, or late, someone would still put together reel and spindle and spin the right thread to the answer. Morgaine jerked her head up angrily. It was all too easy to fall into trance at the spinning. But she must do her share. There must be thread to weave this winter, and the ladies were making a cloth for banquets. Kai was not the only man under 50 in the castle. There was Kevin the bard, who had come here with news from the summer country. How slowly the spindle moved toward the floor, twist, twist the thread, as if her fingers had life of their own, apart from her own life. Even in Avalon she had hated to spin. In Avalon, among the priestesses, she had tried to take more than her share of the work among the dye-pots to avoid the hated spinning. which set her mind roaming as her fingers moved. As the thread turned, it was like the spiral dance along the Tor, round and round, as the world turned round the sun in the sky, though ignorant folk thought it was the other way. Things were not always as they seemed. It might be that the reel went round the thread, as the thread went round itself over and over, spinning like a serpent, like a dragon in the sky. If she were a man and could ride out with the Carlean legion, at least she need not sit and spin, 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 round and round. But even the Carlean legion went round the Saxons, and the Saxons went round them, round and round, as the blood went round in their veins. Red blood, flooding, flooding, spilling over the hearth. Morgaine heard her own shriek only after it had shattered the silence in the room. She dropped the spindle, which rolled away into the blood, which flooded crimson, spilling, spurting over the hearth. "Morgaine, sister, did you prick your hand on the reel? What ails you?"
"Blood on the hearth," Morgaine stammered. "See, there, there, just before the king's high seat. Slain there like a slaughtered sheep before the king."
Elaine shook her. Dizzied, Morgaine passed her hand before her eyes. There was no blood, only the slow crawl of the afternoon sun.
"Sister, what did you see?" asked Guinevere gently.
"Mother goddess, it has happened again." Morgaine tried to steady her breathing. "Nothing, nothing. I must have fallen asleep and dreamed for a moment."
"Didn't you see anything?"
Calla, the fat wife of the steward, peered avidly at Morgaine. Morgaine remembered the last time, more than a year ago, when she had gone into trance over her spinning, and foreseen that Kai's favourite horse had broken its leg in the stables and must have its throat cut. She said impatiently, "No, nothing but a dream. I dreamed last night of eating goose, and I've not tasted it since Easter. Must every dream be a portent?"
"If you're going to prophesy, Morgaine," teased Elaine,
"you should tell us something sensible, like, when will the men be home, so we may have the wine warmed, or whether Melias is making swaddling bands for a girl or a boy, or when the queen will get pregnant." "Shut up, you beast," hissed Calla,
for Guinevere's eyes had filled with tears. Morgaine's head was splitting with the aftermath of unsought trance. It seemed that little lights were crawling before her eyes, pale shining worms of colour that would grow and spread over her whole field of vision. She knew she should let it pass, but even as that knowledge crossed her mind, she exploded.
"I'm so weary of that old jest. I am no village wise woman to meddle with birth charms and love potions and foretellings and spells.
I am a priestess, not a witch."
"Come, come," Melias said peacefully. "Let Morgaine be. This sun is enough to make anyone see things that aren't there, even if she did see blood spilt on the hearth. It's just as like that some lack-witted serving-man will overset a half-roasted joint there, and the red gravy spill down. Will you drink, lady?"
She went to the bucket of water, dipped the ladle, and held it out, and Morgaine drank thirstily.
"I never heard that most prophecy came to aught. One might as well ask her when Elaine's father will finally catch and slay that dragon he goes off to pursue, in and out of season."
Predictably, the diversion worked. Calla jested.
"If there was ever a dragon at all, and he was not merely seeking an excuse to go abroad from home when he was weary of the hearth."
"If I were a man and wedded to Pellinore's lady," Elena said, "I might well prefer the company of a dragon I could not find to the company of one in my bed."
"Tell me, Elaine," asked Melias,
Is there truly a dragon, or does your father follow it because it is simpler than seeing to his cows? Men need not sit and spin when there is war. But when there is peace, they may grow weary of the fowl yard and the pasture, I suppose.
I've never seen the dragon, Elaine said.
God forbid.
But something takes the cows from time to time. And once I did see a great slime trail in the fields and smell the stench. And a cow lay there quite eaten away and covered with a foul slime. Not the work of a wolf, that, nor even a glutton.
Cows vanishing, jeered Calla. The fairy folk are not, I suppose, too good Christians to steal a cow now and then, when the deer are not to be found.
And speaking of cows, Guinevere said firmly, I think I must ask Kai whether there is a sheep or a kid for slaughter.
We need meat. Should the men come home this night or tomorrow, we cannot feed them all on porridge and buttered bread. And even the butter is beginning to fail in this heat. Come with me, Morgaine.
I would that your sight could tell me when we shall have rain. All of you, clear the thread and wool from the benches here, and put the work away. Elaine, child, take my embroidery work to my chamber, and see that nothing spots it.
As they went toward the hallway, she said, low, Did you truly see blood, Morgaine?
I dreamed,
repeated Morgaine stubbornly.
Guinevere looked at her sharply, but there was real affection between them sometimes, and she didn't pursue the subject.
If you did, God grant it be Saxon blood, and spilt far from this hearth.
Come, let us ask Kai about the stock kept for meat.
It's no season for hunting, and I have no wish to have the men about and hunting here when they come again.
She yawned. I wish the heat would break. We might yet have a thunderstorm. The milk was soured this morning. I should tell the maids to make clabber cheese with what's left of it, not throw it to the pigs.
You are a notable housewife, Guinevere, Morgaine said wryly.
I would not have thought of that, so that it was out of my sight. But the smell of curd cheese clings so to the dairies.
I would rather have the pigs well fattened.
They are fat enough in this weather, with all the acorns ripe, said Guinevere, looking at the sky again. Look, is that a flash of lightning?
Morgaine followed her eyes, seeing the streak of glare across the sky.
Aye, the men will come home wet and cold. We should have hot wine ready for them, she said absent-mindedly.
Then started as Guinevere blinked.
Now do I believe indeed that you have the sight? Certainly there is no sound of hooves, nor no word from the watchtower, Guinevere said. I will tell Kai to be sure there is meat anyway.
And she went along the yard, while Morgaine stood pressing her aching head with one hand.
This is not good.
At Avalon she had learned to control the sight, not let it slip upon her unawares when she wasn't attending. Soon she would be a village witch indeed, peddling charms and prophesying boy or girl children and new lovers for the maidens, from sheer boredom at the pettiness of life among the women. The gossip bored her to spinning, the spinning beguiled her into trance.
One day, no doubt, I would sink low enough to give Guinevere the charm she wants, so that she may bear Arthur a son. Barrenness is a heavy burden for a queen, and only once in these 2 years has she shown any sign of breeding.
Yet she found Guinevere's company and Elaine's endurable. Most of the other women had never had a single thought beyond the next meal or the next reel of thread spun. Guinevere and Elaine had had some learning, and occasionally, sitting at ease with them, she could almost imagine herself peacefully among the priestesses in the House of Maidens. The storm broke just before sunset. There was hail that clattered in the courtyard and bounced on the stones. There was drenching rain, and when the watchtower called down the news of riders, Morgaine never doubted that it was Arthur and his men.
Guinevere called for torches to light the courtyard, and shortly after, the walls of Caerleon were bulging with men and horses. Guinevere had conferred with Kai, and he had slaughtered not a kid, but sheep, so there was meat roasting and hot broth for the men. Most of the legion camped all through the outer court and the field, and like any commander, Arthur saw to the encampment of his men and the stabling of their horses before he came into the courtyard where Guinevere awaited him. His head was bandaged under his helmet, and he leaned a little on Lancelot's arm, but he brushed away her anxious query.
"A skirmish. Jute raiders along the coast. The Saxons of the treaty troops had already cleaned most of them away before we came there. Ha! I smell roast mutton. Is this magic when you didn't know we were coming?"
"Morgaine told me you would come, and there is hot wine as well," said Guinevere.
"Well, well, it's a boon to a hungry man to have a sister who is gifted with the sight," said Arthur, with a jovial smile at Morgaine, which rasped on her aching head and raw nerves.
He kissed her and turned back to Guinevere.
"You are hurt, my husband. Let me see to it."
"No, no. I tell you, it is nothing. I never lose much blood, you know that. Not while I bear this scabbard about me," he said. "But how is it with you, lady, after these many months? I had thought..."
Her eyes filled slowly with tears. "I was wrong again. Oh, my lord, this time I was so sure, so sure." He took her hand in his, unable to express his own disappointment in the face of his wife's pain.
"Well, well, we must certainly get Morgaine to give you a charm," he said.
But he watched, his face momentarily setting into grim lines as Melias welcomed Griflet with a wifely kiss, holding her young, swollen body proudly forward.
"We are not yet old folk, my Guinevere."
"But," Guinevere thought, "I'm not so young either. Most of the women I know, save for Morgaine and Elaine, who are yet unwedded, have great boys and girls by the time they are 20. Igraine bore Morgaine when she was full 15, and Melias is 14 and a half, no more." She tried to look calm and unconcerned, but guilt gnawed within her. Whatever else a queen might do for her lord, her first duty was to give him a son, and she hadn't done that duty, though she had prayed till her knees ached.
"How does my dear lady?"
Lancelot bowed before her, smiling, and she held him out her hand to kiss.
"Once again we return home, and find you only more beautiful than ever. You are the only lady whose beauty never fades. I begin to think God has ordered it so, that when all other women age and grow old and thick and worn, you shall be ever beautiful."
She smiled at him and felt comforted. Perhaps it was just as well that she wasn't pregnant and ugly. She saw that he looked on Melias with a faint, scornful smile, and she felt that she couldn't bear to be ugly before Lancelot. Even Arthur looked shabby, as if he had slept in the same crumpled tunic all through the campaign, and wrapped himself, in mud and rain and weather, in his fine, much-worn cloak. But Lancelot looked as crisp and new, his cloak and tunic as well brushed, as if he had dressed himself for an Easter feast, his hair trimmed and combed smooth, his leather belt polished, and even the eagle feathers in his cap standing up dry and unwilted. He looked, Guinevere thought, more like a king than Arthur himself did. As the serving maidens carried round platters of meat and bread, Arthur drew Guinevere to his side.
"Come, sit here between Lancelot and me, Gwen, and we will talk. It seems long since I heard a voice that wasn't rough and male, or smelled the scent of a woman's gown."
He passed his hand over her braid.
"Come, you too, Morgaine, and sit by me. I'm weary of campaigning. I want to hear small gossip, not the talk of the camp.
He bit into a chunk of bread with eager hunger.
And it is good to eat new-baked bread. I'm tired of hard-baked army bread and meat gone bad by keeping.
Lancelot had turned to smile at Morgaine.
And you? How is it with you, kinswoman? I suppose there's no news from the summer country, or from Avalon. There is another here who is eager to hear it, if there is. My brother Balon rode with us.
I have no news from Avalon, said Morgaine, feeling Guinevere watching her. Or was she looking at Lancelot?
But I haven't seen Balon for many years. I suppose he would have later news than mine. He's there, Lancelot said, gesturing towards the men in the hall. Arthur bid him to dine here as my kinsman, and it would be a kindness in you, Morgaine, to take him a cup of wine from the high table. Like all men, he too is eager for a welcome from some woman, even if it be a kinswoman, and not a sweetheart.
Morgaine took one of the drinking cups, horn bound with wood, that sat on the high table, and beckoned a servant to pour wine into it. Then she raised it between her hands, and went around the table among the knights. She was pleasantly conscious of their regard, even though she knew they would look like this at any well-bred, finely-dressed woman after so many months of campaign. It wasn't a particular compliment to her beauty. At least Balon, who was a cousin, almost a brother, wouldn't eye her so hungrily. "I greet you, kinsman. Lancelot, your brother, sent you some wine from the king's table."
"I beg you to sip it first, lady," he said,
then blinked.
"Morgaine, is it you? I hardly knew you, you've grown so fine. I think of you always in the dress of Avalon, but you are like to my mother indeed. How does the lady?"
Morgaine set the cup to her lips, mere courtesy at this court, but perhaps stemming from a time when gifts from the king were tasted before a guest, when the poisoning of rival kings was not unknown. She handed it to him, and Balon drank a long draught before looking up at her again. "I had hoped to have news of Vivien from you, kinsman. I haven't returned to Avalon for many years," she said.
"Aye, I knew that you were in Lot's court," he said. "Did you quarrel with Morgawes? I hear that is easy done by any woman."
Morgaine shook her head. "No, but I wish to be far enough away to stay out of Lot's bed, and that is not easy done. The distance between Orkney and Caerleon is hardly far enough."
"And so you came to Arthur's court to be waiting woman to his queen," said Balon. "It is a more seemly court than that of Morgawes, I dare say. Guinevere guards her maidens well, and makes good marriages for them, too. I see Griflet's lady is already big with her first. Has she not found you a husband, kinswoman?"
Morgaine forced herself to say gaily, "Are you making an offer for me, Sir Balon?" He chuckled.
"You are all too close kin to me, Morgaine, or I should accept your offer. But I heard some gossip that Arthur had intended you for Kai, and that seemed a good match to me, since you've left Avalon after all."
"Kai had no more mind to me than I to him," said Morgaine sharply. "And I have never said I would not return to Avalon, but only on that day when Vivien sends for me to come thither."
"When I was but a lad,"
Balon said, and for a moment, his dark eyes resting on Morgaine, she thought that indeed she could see the resemblance to Lancelot, even in this great coarse man.
"I thought ill of the lady, of Vivien, that she didn't love me as it was fit for a mother to do. But I think better of it now. As a priestess, she could not have had leisure to rear a son, and so she gave me into the hands of one who had no other work than that, and she gave me my foster brother Balin. Oh, yes, as a lad I felt guilty about that too, that I cared more for Balin than for our Lancelot, who is of my own flesh and blood. But now I know Balin is truly my own heart's brother,
And Lancelot, though I admire him for the fine knight he is, will always be a stranger to me.
And too, Balin said seriously, when Vivian gave me up to Dame Priscilla for fostering, she put me into a household where I would come to know the true God and Christ.
It seems to me strange that if I had dwelt in Avalon with my own kin, I should be a heathen, even as Lancelot is.
Morgaine smiled a little.
Well, she said, there I cannot share your gratitude, for I think it ill done of the lady that her own son should abandon her gods.
But even Vivian has often said to me that men should have such manner of religious and spiritual counsel as liked them best,
that which she could give,
or other.
Had I been truly pious and Christian at heart, no doubt she would have let me live by the faith which was strong in my heart. Yet, though I was reared till I was 11 by Igraine, who was as good a Christian as any, I think perhaps it was ordained that I should see the things of the Spirit as they come to us from the Goddess.
"Balin would be able to argue that with you better than I," said Balin, "for he is more pious than I and a better Christian. I should probably say to you what no doubt the priests have said, that there is only one true faith in which man and woman may trust. But you are my kinswoman, and I know my mother to be a good woman, and I have faith that even Christ will take her goodness into account on the last day. As for the rest, I'm no priest, and I see not why I shouldn't leave all those matters to the priests who are schooled in them. I love Balin well, but he should have been a priest, not a warrior, if he is so tender of faith and conscience."
He looked toward the high table and said,
"Tell me, foster sister, you know him better than I, what lies so heavy on our brother Lancelot's heart?"
Morgaine bent her head and said, "If I knew, Balin, it is not my secret to tell."
"You are right to bid me mind my own affairs," said Balin, "but I hate seeing him miserable, and miserable he is. I thought ill of our mother, as I said, because she sent me so young from home. But she gave me a loving foster mother, and a brother of my own age, reared at my side, and as one with me in all things, and a home. She did less well by Lancelot. He was never at home, neither in Avalon, nor yet at the court of Ban of Benwick, where he was dragged up as just another of the king's unregarded bastards. Vivian did ill by him indeed, and I wish Arthur would give him a wife, so he might have a home at last."
"Well," said Morgaine lightly, "if the king wishes me to wed Lancelot, he need only name the day."
"You and Lancelot? Are you not too close kin for that?"
Balin asked, then thought for a moment.
"No, I suppose not. Igraine and Vivian were but half-sisters, and Gorlois and Ban of Benwick are not in any way akin. Though some of the church folk say foster kin should be treated as blood kin for marriage. Well, Morgaine, I will drink to your wedding with pleasure on that day Arthur gives you to my brother, and bids you love him and care for him as Vivian never did. And neither of you need leave court, you the Queen's favourite lady, and Lancelot our King's dearest friend. I hope it comes to pass."
His eyes dwelt on her with kindly concern.
"You too are well past the age when Arthur should give you to some man."
"And why should it be for the king to give me, as if I were one of his horses or dogs?" Morgaine wondered, but shrugged. She had lived long in Avalon. She forgot at times that the Romans had made this the common law, that women were the chattels of their menfolk. The world had changed, and there was no point in rebelling against what could not be altered. Soon after, she began to skirt the edges of the great mead table which had been Guinevere's wedding gift to Arthur. The great hall here in Caerleon, large as it was, wasn't really large enough.
At one point she had to clamber over the benches because the table pushed them so close to the wall to get by the great curve of it. The pot boys and kitchen boys, too, had to sidle past with their smoking platters and cups.
"Is Kevin not here?" asked Arthur. "Then we must have Morgaine to sing for us. I am hungry, too, for harps and all the things of civilized men. I'm not surprised the Saxons spent all their time making war. I have heard the dismal howling of their singers, and they have no reason to stay home."
Morgaine asked one of Kai's helpers around the castle to fetch her harp from her chamber. He had to climb around the curve of the bench and lost his footing. Only the quickness of Lancelot, reaching out to steady boy and harp, kept the instrument from falling. Arthur frowned.
"It was good of my father-in-law to send me this great round mead table," he said, "but there's no chamber in Caerleon large enough for it. When the Saxons are driven away for good, I think I must build a hall just to hold it." "Then will it never be built?" Kai laughed. "To say, when the Saxons are driven away for good, is like to saying, when Jesus shall come again, or when hell freezes, or when raspberries grow on the apple trees of Glastonbury.
Or when King Pellinor catches his dragon." Milius giggled.
Arthur smiled.
"You must not make fun of Pellinor's dragon," he said, "for there is word it has been seen again, and he's off to find it and slay it this time. Indeed, he asked the Merlin if he knew any dragon-catching spells."
"Oh, aye. It's been seen. Like a troll on the hills turned to stone by daylight. Or the ringstones dancing on the night of the full moon," Lancelot jibed. "There are always people who see whatever vision they will. Some see saints and miracles. Some see dragons or the old fairy folk. But never did I know of living man or woman who had seen either dragon or fairy."
Morgaine remembered, against her will, the day in Avalon when she had gone searching for roots and herbs and strayed into the strange country where the fairy woman had spoken with her and had sought to foster her child. What, indeed, had she seen? Or had it been only the sick fantasy of a breeding woman?
"You say that, when you were yourself fostered as Lancelot of the Lake?" she asked quietly.
And Lancelot turned round to her. He said,
"There are times when that seems unreal to me. Is it not so for you, sister?"
She said, "It is true indeed. But at times I am homesick for Avalon."
"Aye, and I too, kinswoman," he said.
Never since that night of Arthur's marriage, by word or look, had he implied that he had ever felt anything more for her than for a childhood companion and a foster sister. She had thought she had long accepted the pain of that, but it struck her anew as his dark, beautiful eyes met hers in such kindness.
"Soon or late, it must seem even as Balin said. We are both unmarried. The king's sister and his best friend."
Arthur said,
"Well, when the Saxons are driven away for good, and don't laugh as if that were a fabulous event, it can be done now, and I think they know it. Then I shall build myself a castle and a great hall big enough for even this table. I've already chosen the site. It's a hill fort, which was there long before Roman times, looking down on the lake itself, and near to your father's island kingdom, Guinevere. You know the place, where the river flows into the lake."
"I know," she said. "When I was a small child, I went there one day to pick strawberries. There was an old ruined well, and we found elf bolts there. The old folk who lived on the chalk had left their arrows." How strange, Guinevere thought, to remember that there had been a time when she had liked to go abroad under the wide, high sky, not even caring whether there was a wall or the safety of an enclosure. And now she grew sick and dizzy if she went out from the walls, where she couldn't see or touch them.
Sometimes now she felt the lump of fear in her belly, even when she walked across the courtyard, and had to hurry to touch the safety of the wall again.
"It's an easy place to fortify," Arthur said, "though I hope when we are done with the Saxons we may have leisure and peace in this island." "An ignoble wish for a warrior, brother," said Kai. "What will you do in time of peace?"
"I will call Kevin the Bard to make songs, and I will break my own horses and ride them for pleasure," Arthur said.
"My companions and I will raise our sons without putting a sword in every little hand before it is full grown to manhood. And I need not fear they will be lamed or slain before they are full grown. Kai, would it not be better if you need not have been sent to war before you were old enough to guard yourself? Sometimes I feel it wrong that it was you, not I, who was lamed, because Ectorius wanted me kept safe for Uther."
He looked with concern and affection at his foster brother, and Kai grinned back at him.
"And," said Lancelot, "we will keep the arts of war alive by holding games as they did in the days of the ancients, and crown the winner of the games with laurel wreaths." "What is laurel, Arthur? And does it grow in these islands? Or is it only in the land of Achilles and Alexander?"
"The Merlin could tell you that," Morgaine said, when Arthur looked perplexed. "I know not either, but whether or no we have laurel, there are plants enough to make wreaths for the victors at your games."
"And we will give garlands to harpers, too," Lancelot said.
"Sing, Morgaine."
"I'd better sing for you now," Morgaine said, "for I do not suppose when you men hold your games you will let women sing."
She took up the harp and began to play. She was sitting nearly where she had been sitting this afternoon when she saw blood spilled forth on the king's hearth. Would it truly come to pass, or was it fantasy? Why, indeed, should she think she still possessed the sight? It never came upon her now, save in these unwelcome trances. She began to sing an ancient lament which she had heard at Tintagel, a lament of a fisherwoman who had seen the boats swept out to sea. She knew that she held them all with her voice, and in the silence of the hall she fell to singing old songs of the islands which she had heard at Lot's court, a legend of the seal woman who had come out of the sea to find a mortal lover, songs of the solitary woman herders, songs for spinning and for carding flax. Even when her voice grew weary, they called for more, but she held up her hand in protest. "Enough! No, truly, I can sing no more. I am hoarse as any raven." Soon after, Arthur called the servants to extinguish the torches in the hall and light the guests to bed. It was one of Morgaine's tasks to see that the unmarried women who waited on the queen were safely put to sleep in the long loft room behind the queen's own chamber, at the opposite end of the building from the soldiers and armsmen. But she lingered a moment, her eyes on Arthur and Guinevere, who were bidding Lancelot good night.
"I have told the women to prepare the best spare bed for you, Lancelot," said Guinevere.
But he laughed and shook his head. "I'm a soldier. It's my duty to see horses and men bedded safe for the night before I sleep."
Arthur chuckled, his arm around Guinevere's waist.
"We must get you married, Lance, and you will not spend your nights so cold. I made you my captain of horse, but you needn't spend your nights lying down among them."
Guinevere felt a pain within her breast as she met Lancelot's eyes. It seemed to her that she could almost read his thoughts, that he would say aloud again as he had said once, "My heart is so full of my queen, I have no room there for any other lady." She held her breath, but Lancelot only sighed and smiled at her, and she thought, "No, I am a wedded wife, a Christian woman. It is sin even to think such thoughts. I must do penance." And then, feeling her throat so tight she couldn't swallow, she felt the thought come unbidden. "Penance enough that I must be apart from the one I love." And she gasped aloud, so that Arthur turned startled eyes on her. What is it, love? Have you hurt yourself?
A pin pricked me, she said,
and turned her eyes away, pretending to hunt for the pin at the folds of her dress. She saw Morgaine watching her and bit her lip.
She is always watching me, and she has the sight.
Does she know all my sinful thoughts?
Is that why she looks on me so scornfully?
Yet Morgaine had never shown her anything but a sister's kindness. And when she had been pregnant, in the first year of their marriage, when she had taken a fever and miscarried the child within 5 months, she couldn't bear to have any of her ladies about her, and Morgaine had cared for her almost like a mother. Why now was she so ungrateful? Lancelot bade them good night again, and withdrew. Guinevere was almost painfully conscious of Arthur's arm around her waist, the frank eagerness in his eyes. Well, they had been apart a long time. But she felt a sudden, sharp resentment. Not once since that time have I been pregnant. Can he not even give me a child? Oh, but surely that was her own fault. One of the midwives had told her it was like a sickness in cattle when they cast their calves unborn, time after time. And sometimes women took that sickness too, so that they couldn't carry a child more than a month or two, 3 at the most. Somehow, through carelessness, she must have taken that illness, gone perhaps into the dairy at the wrong time, or drunk of milk from a cow who had cast her calf. And so the life of her lord's son and heir had been forfeit, and it was all her doing. Torn with guilt, she followed Arthur into their chamber.
"It's more than a jest, Gwen," said Arthur, sitting to draw off his leather hose. "We must get Lancelot married. Have you seen how all the lads run to him, and how good he is with them? He should have sons of his own."
"I have it, Gwen. We will marry him to Morgaine." "No."
The word was torn from her before she thought, and Arthur looked at her, startled.
"What's the matter with you? Doesn't it seem perfect, the right choice? My dear sister and my best friend, and their children, mark you, would be next heirs to our throne, in any case, if it should be that the gods send us no children." "No, no. Don't cry, my love," he begged.
And Guinevere knew, humiliated and shamed, that her face had twisted with weeping.
"I meant not to reproach you, my dearest love. Children come when the goddess wills. But only she knows when we will have children, or if we will ever have them at all. And although Gawain is dear to me, I have no will to put a son of Lot on the throne if I should die. Morgaine is my own mother's child, and Lancelot my cousin.
Surely it cannot matter to Lancelot whether or no he has sons," said Guinevere. "His 5th, or is it 6th, son to King Ban, and bastard born at that."
"I never thought to hear you, of all people, reproach my kinsman and dearest friend with his birth," Arthur said. "And he is no ordinary bastard, but son to the Grove and the great marriage."
"Pagan harlotries! If I were King Ban, I would clean all such sorcerous filth from my kingdom.
And so should you."
Arthur shifted uneasily, clambering under the bed cover.
"Lancelot would have little cause to love me if I drove his mother from this kingdom. And I am sworn to honour Avalon by the sword they gave me at my king-making."
Guinevere looked at the great sword Excalibur, where it hung over the edge of the bed in its magical scabbard, covered with mystical symbols that seemed to shine with pale silver, and mock at her. She put out the light and lay down beside Arthur, saying,
"Our Lord Jesus would safeguard you better than any such wicked enchantments. You did not have to do with any of their vile goddesses and sorcery before you were made king, did you? I know such things were done in Uther's day. but this is a Christian land.
Arthur shifted uneasily and said, There are many folk in this land, the old people, who dwelt here long before Rome came to us. We cannot take their gods from them. And what befell before my crowning?
Well, that touches you not, my Guinevere.
Men cannot serve two masters, said Guinevere, surprised at her own daring. I would have you altogether a Christian king, my lord.
I owe allegiance to all my people, said Arthur, not those alone who follow Christ.
It seems to me, said Guinevere, that those are your enemies, not the Saxons. The true warfare for a Christian king is only against those who do not follow Christ.
Arthur laughed uneasily at that.
Now do you sound like the Bishop Patricius? He would have us Christianize the Saxons rather than putting them to the sword, so that we may live at peace with them. For my part, I am like to the priests who were here in the older days, who were asked to send missionaries to the Saxons. Know you what they said, my wife?
No, I have never heard.
They said they would send no missionaries to the Saxons, lest they be forced to meet them in peace, even before God's throne.
Arthur laughed heartily, but Guinevere didn't smile. And after a time he sighed.
Well, think on it, my Guinevere. It seems to me the best possible marriage, my dearest friend and my sister. Then would he be my brother, and his sons my heirs.
In the darkness his arms went round her, and he added,
But now we must strive to make it come to pass that we will need no other heirs, you and I, my love, but those you can give to me.
God grant it, whispered Guinevere, moving into his arms, and tried to close away everything out of her mind but Arthur, here in her arms.
Morgaine, lingering after she had seen the women to bed, stood near the window, restless. Elaine, who shared her bed, murmured to her,
Come and sleep, Morgaine. It's late. You must be weary.
She shook her head. I think it is the moon that has gotten into my blood tonight. I'm not sleepy. She was unwilling to lie down and close her eyes. Even if she hadn't the sight, it was her imagination which would torment her. All round her the newly returned men joined with their wives. She thought, with a wry smile in the darkness, It is like to Beltane in Avalon. Even the soldiers who weren't wedded, she was sure, had somehow found women for this night. Everyone, from the king with his wife down to the stableman, lay in someone's arms tonight, except for the queen's maidens. Guinevere thought it her duty to guard their chastity, even as Balin had said.
And I am guarded with the queen's maidens.
Lancelot, at Arthur's wedding. That had come to nothing through no fault of their own. And Lancelot had stayed away from the court as often as he might. No doubt so that he need not see Guinevere in Arthur's arms. But he is here now. And like herself, he was alone this night, among soldiers and horsemen, no doubt dreaming of the queen, of the one woman in the kingdom he could not have. For surely every other woman at court, wedded or maiden, was as willing to have him as she herself. Save for bad fortune at Arthur's wedding, she would have had him. And, honourable as he was, if he had made her pregnant, he would have married her. Not that it is likely I would have conceived, with the harm I suffered at Gwydion's birth. But I needn't have told him that. And I could have made him happy, even if I could not bear him a son. There was a time he wanted me, before ever he saw Guinevere, and after too. Save for mischance, I would have made him forget her in my arms. And I'm not so undesirable as that. When I was singing tonight,
Many of the knights looked on me with desire. I could make Lancelot desire me. Elaine said impatiently, "Will you not come to bed, Morgaine?"
"Not yet a while. I think I will walk a little out of doors," said Morgaine, though this was forbidden to the Queen's women, and Elaine shrank back with that timidity which so exasperated Morgaine. She wondered if Elaine had caught it from the Queen like a fever, or a new fashion in wearing veils.
"Are you not afraid with all the men encamped about?"
Morgaine laughed. "Well, think you not I am weary of lying alone?" But she saw that the jest offended Elaine, and said, more gently, "I am the king's sister. None would touch me against my will. Do you really think me so tempting no man could resist me? I am 26, not a dainty young virgin like yourself, Elaine."
Morgaine lay down without undressing beside Elaine. In the darkness and silence, as she had feared, her imagination, or was it the sight, made pictures. Arthur with Guinevere, men with women, all round her throughout the castle, joined in love or simple lust. And Lancelot, was he alone too? Memory attacked her again, more intense than imagination. And she remembered that day, bright sunlight on the tour, Lancelot's kisses running that first awakening knife-sharp through her body, and the bitterness of regret that she was pledged elsewhere. And then, when Arthur was wedded to Guinevere, and he had come near to tearing off her clothes and having her there in the stables, he had wanted her then. Now, sharp as the sight, the picture came to her mind. Lancelot walking in the courtyard, alone, his face empty with loneliness and frustration. "I have not used the sight nor my own magic to draw him to me in selfish purpose. It came to me unsought. Silently, moving quietly so as not to waken the younger girl, she freed herself from Elaine's arm, slid gently from the bed. She had taken off only her shoes. She stooped now to draw them on, then silently went from the room, moving as noiselessly as a wraith from Avalon. If it is a dream born of my own imagination, if he's not there, I will walk a little in the moonlight to cool my fever, and then go back to my bed. There will be no harm done." But the picture persisted in her mind, and she knew that Lancelot was there alone, like herself, wakeful. He too was of Avalon. The sun tides run in his blood too. Morgaine, slipping quietly out of the door past the drowsing watchman, cast a glance at the sky. The moon, a quarter full, flooded down brightly into the stone-flagged space before the stables. No, not here, around to the side. For a moment, Morgaine thought, "He is not here. It was a dream. It was my own fantasy." She almost turned about to go back to her bed, suddenly flooded with shame. Suppose the watchman should come upon her here, and all would know that the king's sister crept about the house after all honest folk were asleep, no doubt bent on harlotries. "Who is it? Stand! Show yourself!" The voice was low and harsh. Lancelot's voice. Suddenly, for all her exultation, Morgaine was afraid. Her sight had shown truly. But what now? Lancelot's hand had gone to his sword. He looked very tall and thin in the shadows. "Morgaine," she said softly. And he let his hand fall from his sword. "Cousin, is it you?" She came out of the shadows, and his face, keen and troubled, softened as he looked at her. "So late. Did you come to seek me? Is there trouble within? Arthur, the Queen?" "Even now he thinks only of the Queen," Morgaine thought. and felt it like a tingling in her fingertips and the calves of her legs, anger and excitement. She said, "No, all is well, as far as I know. I am not privy to the secrets of the royal bedchamber." He flushed, just a shadow on his face in the darkness, and looked away from her. She said, "I could not sleep. How is it you ask me what I am doing here when you yourself are not in your bed? Or has Arthur made you his night watchman?" She could sense Lancelot's smile.
"No more than you. I was restless when all around me slept.
I think perhaps the moon has gotten into my blood." It was the same phrase she had used to Elaine, and somehow it struck her as a good omen, a symbol that their minds worked in tune and that they responded one to the call of the other, as a silent harp vibrates when a note on another is struck. Lancelot went on, speaking softly, into the darkness at her side.
"I am restless these nights, thinking of so many nights of battle."
"And you wish yourself back in battle, like all soldiers?" He sighed.
"No, although perhaps it is unworthy of a soldier to dream early and late of peace."
"I do not think so," Morgaine said softly. "For what do you make war, except that peace may come for all our people? If a soldier loves his trade overmuch, then he becomes no more than a weapon for killing. What else brought the Romans to our peaceful isle but the love of conquest and battle for its own sake?" Lancelot smiled.
"Your father was one of those Romans, cousin. So was mine."
"Yet I think more of the peaceful tribes, who wanted no more than to till their barley crops in peace and worship the goddess. I am of my mother's people, and yours."
"Aye, but those mighty heroes of old we spoke of before, Achilles, Alexander, they all felt war and battle the proper business of a man. And even now, in these islands, it has come to be that all men think of battle first, and peace as no more than a quiet and womanly interlude."
He sighed.
"These are heavy thoughts. It is no wonder sleep is far from us, Morgaine. Tonight I would give all the great weapons ever forged, and all the gallant songs of your Achilles and Alexander's, for an apple from the branches of Avalon."
He turned his head away. Morgaine slipped her hand within his own.
"So would I, cousin. I don't know why I'm homesick for Avalon. I didn't live long there,"
Lancelot said, musing.
"And yet I think it is the fairest place on all earth, if indeed it is on this earth at all. The old druid magic, I think, took it from this world, because it was all too fair for us imperfect men, and must be like a dream of heaven, impossible."
He recalled himself with a little laugh.
"My confessor wouldn't like to hear me say these things."
Morgaine chuckled, low. "Have you become a Christian, then, Lance?"
"Not a good one, I fear," he said.
"Yet their faith seems to me so simple and good. I wish I could believe it.
They say, 'Believe what you have not seen. Profess what you do not know.' That is more virtuous than believing what you have seen. Even Jesus, they say, when he rose from the dead, chided a man who would have thrust his hands into the Christ's wounds to see that he wasn't a ghost or a spirit. For it was more blessed to believe without seeing."
"But we shall all rise again," said Morgaine, very low. "And again, and again, and again. We do not come once and go to heaven or their hell, but live again and again until we are even as the gods." He lowered his head. Now that her eyes were accustomed to the dimness of the moonlight, she could see him clearly, the delicate line of temple curving inward at the eye, the long, narrow sweep of the jaw, the soft darkness of his brows and his hair curling over it. Again,